This is session 157, the process of transitioning in 300C. If you didn't intend to come to that session, you may want to go to a different session.
Or you can stay.
Or yeah, just stay.
And sit in the front.
You're welcome to sit in the front. Please silence your cell phones out of respect for our presenters. As you listen today, we invite you to explore what it means to be Mormon. Who gets to carry that label? What does the history say? What does the theology say? At this conference, we encourage you to explore what it means to be Mormon. We ask you to reflect on your own Mormon interactions and to hold the good and bad together to create a more full, complete personal narrative. In doing this, we allow others to do the same. Also, if you haven't signed up for the, or if you haven't downloaded the Whova app, it's a really cool way to track the conference, what's going on, and plan meetups, and it's really slick. This session's being recorded, and you'll be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Please consider purchasing Sunstone merchandise to support Sunstone. Tradable lanyard pins, prominent figures in Mormonism. There are also a wide variety of popular Sunstone chapsticks, mugs, bags, and more. This session is 90 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session you clear the room and speak outside so that other presentations can begin on time. So a little about this session. Panelists share stories of their transition out of the LDS Church, what led to their transitions, how did their individual transitions evolve, and how does their relationship with the church and still active loved ones look now? First, we'll hear from Nicholas R. Stewart. Do you go by Nick?
Nicholas is sufficient, yes.
Yes, Nick has a Master's of Urban Planning from San Jose State. He grew up in the Mormon Church, got married in the Los Angeles Temple, and served in four Elders Quorum presidencies. He is no longer an active believing member of the LDS Church. Next, we will hear from Mallory Tallman. Yes. Mallory left the church, LDS Church, 5 years ago while her husband remains faithful. With their three children, they have been working to come together as a family with their different levels of faith after finding their way back from the brink of divorce. Anthony D. Miller will go next. He's an entrepreneur with financial planning and real estate development companies and an adjunct professor of finance. After 20 years of intense church activity, including a stint as a stake high counselor, he and his gay son are now out of the LDS Church, while his wife and adult daughter are fully active. So each one of them is going to take about 15 to 20 minutes or so to present their transition stories, after which time we'll open it up for the last 30 minutes for question and answers. All right, Nick.
I'm going to take this off of here and hope it still works okay. I'm a Pacer, so not Indiana. If you're a jazz fan, Golden State Warriors. My name is Nicholas Stewart. You heard the intro. You can call me Nick when you invariably ask me a question later. I like questions. I was born in Long Beach, California, not quite 40, but, you know, more than 37 years ago. 38 and a half. I was born, like I said, in Long Beach. I was shortly thereafter adopted into a Mormon family. My mother's actually here right now. She's in the second row because she sits in the front. I grew up essentially in this church. I was a Mormon. I still am, for all practical purposes, except for being believing and attending, Mormon. My Mormon cred is, you know, kind of up and down. Been in a lot of Elders Quorum presidencies. Was inactive for a lot of time in teenage and 20s. Didn't go on a mission because I'm not a salesman. it wasn't my thing. So I'm kind of unique, I feel, in most of the communities that I am in when it comes to post-Mormon, ex-Mormon, no longer active believing, any of the various monikers you want to use, because I never really believed. So I was a member, you know, I've been Mormon my entire life, and I never really believed it. So that's always kind of put me in an interesting spot. When I was active, you know, I was surrounded by people who believed it, and it was like they knew it was true, and I was like, I'm kind of jealous, because to me it's just this thing that I inherited. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that sounds okay, like a lot of stuff sounds cool, but the reality for me was like I just don't feel the same thing that you guys all feel. So because of that, when I was like 16, 17, I kind of started going in. I went less active. Basically, I got a driver's license and a car. And my parents let me drive myself to church, which means I left church right after the sacrament got passed. But I was smart. I came back at the end of the 3-hour block, so they'd see me in the parking lot and think I was there the whole time. I'm a smart person every once in a while. By 18, like right after I turned 18 and graduated high school, they made me an elder, and I stopped going to church for 5, 6, 7 years, something like that. Came back to church, YSA ward, bunch of elder quorum presidencies, married in the temple, blah, 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 blah. So a couple years ago, so when Kate Kelly was excommunicated, I had an opportunity with my wife to have a conversation about the church and feelings I had. And I was not like super descriptive. I was very vague, because I wasn't sure how she would respond. My wife is a return missionary. You know, she is where she is on her faith journey. But you know, at the time I had no reason to believe she was anything other than really, really Mormon. You know, she wanted to go to the temple like every month, and I was like, please no. But I didn't say that out loud, just in my head, of course. So the Kate Kelly thing was kind of a door for me, because my wife is also a feminist, and so it was a way for me to kind of broach some tricky, quote-unquote, topics about the church with, you know, with her. And that opened the door for a lot of other conversation. Trying to remember exactly when it was. I think it was 3 years ago. 3.5, something like that. I was still attending. I was in the San Francisco Bay Area. I was in the Alameda ward, which is probably the best ward in the entire church. Not that I'm biased. And I basically came out to my bishop. And I told my bishop, I was like, look, here's the deal. I don't buy into this stuff. Like, there's great people here in this ward. There's great people in the church. I don't mind holding my calling, teaching elders quorum. That changed slightly after that. But, like, I like being here. But don't ask me to pray. Don't ask me to give a talk in sacrament meeting unless you're going to tell me the topic ahead of time, and I'm allowed to say no, because there's certain topics I'm not going to teach. Like, Joseph Smith is great. I'm never going to teach that. Things like that. I was like, as long as we're okay with boundaries, I'll still be here until I'm not. And my bishop was like, cool. As long as you're here. We're just glad that you're here. I was like, cool. I was like, since I'm talking to you, I also drink now. He's like, okay, that's less good. I was like, yeah. I said, also, I'm bisexual. And he goes, yeah, so the drinking's not good. It's like, cool, I get it. You don't care about that one. Good to know. So that was like my coming out to my bishop. So after that, I figured I should probably come out to my wife, too. So I did that eventually. And that went actually fairly well, all things considered, because my wife is fairly liberal believing in general. But I kept attending for a while. Oh, and I told my mom, I was very opportunistic in that. I had been in the hospital for several weeks, and she was nice enough to come stay with me in the hospital. And I took the opportunity. It was like 2 a.m. or something, and I'm like laying there on like morphine or something. And I'm like, hey, so mom, we should talk. I think she was just happy I wasn't dying. I picked my battles. But yeah, so I kept attending for a while until I stopped attending altogether about 1.5 years ago. I was less active for almost 1 year before that. The final straw for me was actually teaching an Elders Quorum lesson, and I loved teaching Elders Quorum. I loved it. I served in 4 Elders Quorum presidencies. I volunteered to teach whenever I could, because the lessons then would be not horrible. Not that I think I'm a fabulous teacher, but when you control the message, it's way more tolerable. It was a lesson, and I, like an idiot, didn't read the manual ahead of time. So I showed up and opened the manual, and I was like, Joseph Smith, great. But I did what I always did, and I got through the lesson. I managed to not spill the beans on a variety of issues, which would have been very off-putting to members of that quorum. I tried to convey the fact that there's a very large spectrum of opinion about Joseph Smith. Some good, some not very good at all. But again, I was in the Bay Area, where Mormonism isn't necessarily more true, but it's definitely more open. So it went fairly well. But on my way out of the room, I handed my lesson manual to my Elders Quorum president. I said, Tim, you're a great guy. You need to find someone else. This isn't for me anymore. And Tim's like, no, that's fine. Can we talk about this later? I was like, sure, not a problem. I came back to the church later that afternoon. He had some meetings, and we talked. And I feel really bad for that conversation because I really unloaded on him. He's a really nice guy. He actually works for the church in the temple department. Super nice guy. He's from, I don't know, some farm community here in Utah. I can't remember what it's called, but it sounds very, very small. No, that I've heard of. Duchesne. He's from Duchesne. I don't know. Anyways. So I sat down and talked to him, and he was like, I just don't understand why you feel this way. And then it all just came out. I will not use all the same words that I use when I talk to him. And that's honestly, I think, my biggest regret is the words that I chose. I was not very thoughtful in my words, because I was just kind of fed up at that point. Especially because he still is a good friend of mine, and I know he's very believing, but he's also a very loving person and cares about people. But I just let him have it. He was like the proxy for all the times that someone got up in Elders Quorum and was like, gays are evil, they're going to hell. Or every time there was one particular guy in that ward who one time in a lesson said, well, you know, slavery was good for black people because it brought them to America where they could receive the gospel. I was like, oh! So my poor friend Tim, the Elders Quorum president, was the proxy for all of those moments. He's still my friend, though, which is nice. But I stopped going to church after that. I still went to ward functions. I went to Christmas dinners and barbecues and anything that wasn't church. I still technically did home teaching. Technically, I home taught my friend Tim, the Elders Quorum president. We agreed that home teaching we would try a new restaurant in town. He and I and our wives would go out and try some new restaurant that opened. We didn't talk church, except maybe, you know, like, oh yeah, you know, so and so, you know, they're moving. Catching up about people. We didn't talk doctrine or gospel. That was not what I was there for. We were there to eat food, and I like food. So through all of this, I relied a lot on internet communities, which is how I met these guys, these people. Clearly only one guy. These people. I'm trying to be inclusive. Online communities are huge. I think one of the biggest things for me was just having people who I could talk to, who got it. Although for me, one of my biggest problems is that because I was never really that in the church, and never really believing, and I was a coastal California Mormon, my experiences in the church were really different than so many people that are active in post-X whatever Mormon groups. You know, I don't have any bad mission stories. I really didn't experience ecclesiastical abuse, none of that kind of stuff. I've been very lucky, so I always had a hard time fitting in. At two different times, I've been excommunicated from Facebook groups, because in one case I wasn't nice enough, and another time I was less nice again. I'm back in that one now, it's great. So I think that, you know, like one of the big things that I kind of learned going through all of this, especially again as someone who was always kind of on the fringe when he was Mormon, is being able to have support. you know, again, I was fortunate with the people in my ward, with my wife, with my, you know, with my mom and my other members, my family, who've been very good about the fact that, you know, things seem to have suddenly changed overnight. One day I'm, you know, going to church and I'm teaching elders quorum and doing all that stuff, and the next day I'm like drinking coffee and, you know, other things. So one of the things that I see come up a lot in the X/post/whatever you want to call it Mormon groups is the fact that the more that people change, the more they stay the same. It's cliche, but it's true. I see a lot of black and white thinking that continues. They just switch what they see as black and what they see as white. And as a biracial person, I find that hilarious. But thank you. And another one, I appreciate that. And like, you know, the purity test stuff, you know, are you really are you really ex-Mormon? I've dealt with that myself. People go, well, you're defending the church too much. I just don't hate the church on certain issues. And so I just don't feel the same because I wasn't as invested in the first place, right? So one of the reasons that I actually kind of wanted to do this panel, and this is kind of a replica of what I did last year here, is because of this. I think it's important for people to be able to tell tell the how and the why of leaving the church, the process of it, why they did it, kind of what they learned from it, because we're not all actually the same. I feel like in Mormonism and other religions and lots of groups in general, there's a lot of, you know, to quote a former president, you're with us or you're against us. There's a lot of, like, you're one of us. If you're one of us, then all these boxes are checked. If you can't check all these boxes, then you're over there. And so I think that it's important for people to hear different stories, different points of view. And yeah, I'm a little biased. I feel like my story is different enough because I never really believed. So I'm a little selfish in that regard. I want to tell that because I think it's important that people know that I and people like me exist. But I think that that's just kind of informs the narrative of ex-Mormonism, which, by the way, I don't necessarily like that term, ex-Mormon. That's why I keep saying ex/post/whatever. If people ask me, I say that I'm an inactive, non-believing, apathetic atheist Mormon. I generally dislike labels, but that's the most accurate. I'm still technically Mormon. I'm one of the numbers they count. If they had my address, they'd send people to my door. I just don't happen to believe in God because I don't have proof, and I honestly don't care since I'm apathetic. Just happens to fit. But I use ex-Mormon because it's the most, you know, all around. But yeah, so I just think it's important that, you know, we understand that there's different voices, there's different viewpoints. People come from different places, just like in the church, people come from different places. Like I said, when I was growing up, I was always kind of jealous of those folks who knew it. They could get up and they could say, I know. I used to be so mad that I was born in the church and wasn't a convert, because I was born into it, so I didn't have to do any work to get there. Converts had to, like, do things. They had to, like, meet with missionaries, and they had to read the Book of Mormon and pray. I just grew up in it. It was there. I was Mormon because my parents were, right? So I was always a little jealous of that. And so I just think that, you know, hearing different viewpoints and understanding we come from different places, we're all going different places, but that there's no one... is that on the thing this year? The more than one way to Mormon? We all are different places in the spectrum. We all do and see things differently. But there's no one right or wrong way to do it. And so I just think that's kind of important for everybody, whether you're active believing, super TBM, which makes you wonder why you're here, or wherever you are, there's always people who, even if on the outside they look like a duck and sound like a duck, are not necessarily ducks. That's just how it is. And that's fine. I think one of the biggest detriments to the church is just that when I say the church, I refer to the institution, not the people. But I think that one of the biggest failings of the church is that it tries to make everyone the same. and it doesn't seem to be very open to the, you know, disparate viewpoints that exist. And I think that's kind of one of its biggest failings, and it's unfortunate. I know lots of people who would probably still be active Mormons if they felt that they were heard at church, that there was someone there who cared about a viewpoint that wasn't, you know, correlated. So I think that for me, like my big takeaway is just, you know, when you go out into whatever sphere of influence you have, whether you're an active believing Mormon, whether you're, you know, active believing nuanced cafeteria Mormon, whatever, ex-Mormon, anti-Mormon, whatever label you apply to yourself, just remember that just because someone else uses the same label doesn't mean that they are just like you. And try to embrace the differences and figure out how that all works. Because there's always going to be someone out there in your circle who is like me when I was active, who's not necessarily on the same page, but is still doing their thing and trying to fit in. It's not always a fun place to be. The last thing I want to say before I hand this mic over to Mallory is, and I should have done it at the top, I want to see a show of hands. How many people in the room here right now are active, believing, like attending church folks, whether it's Brighamite Mormonism or one of the others? Okay. I see one of these over there. 40 years, I get it. I did it a long time. All right, so how many people here are, active, believing-ish? I think it's probably more where you fall. Yeah. Okay. How many folks here have, like, left the church, are done with it, officially resigned or excommunicated or left through some method like that? Okay. And how many people are just inactive, non-believing, still technically on the books, but... Okay. I like this cross-section. It's a good cross-section. I like this. It's cool. Yeah, that's good too. Is that you? Great, y'all are my people. After the end of this, I would love to hear about why you still attend, because I think that's interesting, and I suspect I know the answers for a lot of folks, because it was the same for me for a lot of time. Anyways, that's all I'm going to say. I'm happy to pontificate more through questions later. When I was teaching Elders Quorum, I was a big fan of questions. I ask questions. And they're not rhetorical. I want you guys to do the same for us when we're done. Hold us accountable for things we say. Anyways, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Nick, for being vulnerable with us. Give him a hand. You can stand. You want to stand up?
Yeah, I'll just put this here. I'm not a pacer. At least I don't think I am. I don't really do presentations very often. So I'm Mallory Tolman. I grew up in the church. I was born to goodly parents, like just all that, you know, standard Mormonism. I was raised in Ohio. When I was a teenager, my dad was actually my bishop. And I like one of my favorite things to do, to tell people and to even show them if I can find it, is I have a family picture of me and my three sisters and my parents all dressed in temple clothes. And we're at it's a photography studio, but it was like a white room with like columns, so it looks very celestial. Like all of us just, you know, lounging together in our temple clothes, because that is the goal, right? Celestial family goal. So I think it's always kind of a funny thing to like, oh yeah, this is my Mormon cred, talking about Mormon cred there. And I met my husband and we got married in the temple and we started having children. I have three children now, and we lived close to my family at that point. And then when we moved away from my family, I had this moment where I finally had to like find myself. I went to college very, very young, and like I was just always expected to be very mature and like ahead of myself, and I never had that like youth exploration time. So here I am, 30 years old, with pink and purple hair. Thank you. Yes.
Fabulous.
Thank you. But like, I moved away from my family, and I realized, like, oh, I have to figure out who I am. And I had always been believing in the church. I went to EFY. I went to girls' camp. I grew up in a very tiny, tiny ward. And I was like the goody-goody in Sunday school that was, you know, raising her hand because she had all the answers. Like, I was very in the church. And then all of a sudden, I was away from my family, and I was like, well, what do I really believe? And then I started getting into feminism through the birth world because I'm kind of a hippie, and I did home births, and that's, like, hard to do in certain states. And so I was like, feminism, and I should be able to make my own choice. And then there was the wear pants to church day in 2012. And I don't know if anyone else here is familiar with that first wear pants to church day, but it was huge. It got so much attention online, and none of it was good, it seemed. Like, everyone was like, that is terrible. Women do not wear pants to church. That's so disrespectful. And that was when it hit me. I was like, that is ridiculous. You can wear pants to church. Like, it was so clear to me then, like, that there was something wrong with the church culture. And so I joined FMH Facebook group, and I started, like, spending all my time, and I was introduced to these new ideas, and everybody is like, watch out for your soul, you know, the slippery slope. And it was like comment after comment from not just people on Facebook, but people who were my friends, people who were my family, and it hurt so much hearing every day, like, that I was sowing seeds of doubt and discord, and that I'm on a slippery slope, or I'm in the grasp of Satan. And, like, these are actual things that people that I cared about and that I thought cared about me were telling me. And it was just a relentless, like, struggle for me to actually feel like I could be myself and that I could express my own beliefs, my own opinions. And so I continued with the feminism movement, the writing letters to let women pray, and the ordained women, which I actually never got on board with. Well, not that I wasn't on board with it, but I was afraid to put my face out there as a supporter of that, because my mom was all like, well, at least you don't want the priesthood. Sorry, Mom. But... through all of this, my husband, who is a believing member still, very active, he was trying to be understanding. And he's like, yeah, I agree you should be able to wear pants, but I don't think that you should wear them as a protest at church. And then, oh yeah, I definitely think women should be able to pray, but the church doesn't change from the people. It has to be the prophet and Heavenly Father. And so, like, every step of the way, he's, like, trying to be gently encouraging, but also, like, maybe this is getting too out of hand. And it got hard. Really, really difficult, our relationship and everything. Because I was trying to make it work. So my introduction actually said that I left the church 5 years ago. So pants was 6 years ago. And I went to church for 4 years, trying so hard to make it work. And I had to be careful with every new thing that came up that was somewhere down that slippery slope. Like, I had to be careful with how I presented it to my husband, to my kids, to my parents, to my in-laws, to, like, everyone, because I wanted them to trust that I was making the right decision for myself, that I was thinking about things seriously, because, well... Let me back up just a little bit. Because I went to college very young, I was only 15 when I started full-time college, I was always the youngest everywhere, everything I did, and people were always like, oh, you're such a baby, and I just wanted to be taken seriously so badly. And so I was afraid that this was just going to be another thing where people were not going to take me seriously because of whatever reason. So I was like trying very, very hard to like let people know that, oh yes, I've been thinking, I've been reading my scriptures, I prayed about this. And I don't know if people actually took me seriously or not, but things kept progressing. And then I had a bishop that wasn't happy with how vocal I was, or I was sharing things on Facebook or whatever, and he was not happy about that. And he actually called my husband into a meeting with him and requested my temple recommend. And my husband was like, what? That's not the way things are done. And so he came home and was like, the bishop wants your temple recommend. And I immediately broke down into tears. And I think that was probably like, that was probably my first like big experience with like a priesthood leader that was not helping me through my faith transition at all. And so I got mad. And I don't know, maybe that wasn't the right thing to do, but I started being more bold. I was still going to church, but I was being more bold, and I started dyeing my hair crazy colors, and I got my ears pierced in all kinds of places, and we had moved to a different ward, and I actually prayed to Heavenly Mother in sacrament meeting, and that got my hand slapped a little bit. But I mean, I was just like doing all these bold things and like formulating, like, this is what I believe. And I, at this point, then I decided that I didn't really believe. I mean, there were so many things going on with LGBTQ, and I identify as bisexual. So, and everyone's like, well, you're in a committed heterosexual marriage, so it doesn't matter because you have a man. But it still hurt, like the policy and just all of the angst that was being felt outside. And that was like my community, but I mean, I'm outside of it, and it was really hard for me. And then I decided that I didn't believe in God because things were too hard, and the people who were claiming that they loved me and that God loved me were hurting me so much. And so I was like, I just can't believe in a God. And I had gone, like, my whole life, I had always believed in God. I had always prayed, and like my family had always encouraged that in me, and so I like all of a sudden had like lost my faith. And I guess it wasn't really all of a sudden, if it took years, but I found myself just done with religion in general. And it was around this time that my husband had been called to be the elders quorum president in our ward. And the stake president, first, before he actually like officially extended the calling that next Sunday, wanted to talk to me. And I had at that point decided that I was going to be very honest. I hadn't renewed my temple recommend because my integrity told me that I wouldn't be able to honestly do that. And so I went in and I talked to the stake president for like an hour and a half. It was a long meeting, and I was just very open with him and told him everything. And he kind of dropped some hints that he was maybe not going to give my husband this calling. And my heart was starting to break because my husband has been so good to put up with everything so far in this. And we were starting to have marriage difficulties through this because it was just getting to be too hard for him. And I told the stake president, I was like, I am willing to support my husband, but if you take away this calling from him, it might be very damaging to our relationship. And I was very worried about that. And he was all, I understand, da da da. And then the next day, that Sunday, he rescinded the calling. So my husband, I was really worried. I'm a little emotional here. I was so worried that my husband was going to resent me. And he did a little. And that was actually really, really terrible for us. And then our ward boundaries were rearranged after that. And so we were in this other ward and barely holding ourselves together. And then I found out that there was a sexual predator attending our ward. So, and I didn't know about it, and my children interacted with this man, and he sat with the primary president, and I just so many like red flags. And I talked to my bishop about it, the new bishop, and he was very like, "Oh yeah, we'll take care of this. We can put together some rules to make it better." And then he called church lawyers, I guess, and came back and said, "We can't do anything." And I was just so frustrated and feeling so much emotion about this, and like in tears. From this and everything else, and like all the callings and the relationships with my husband. And I came home from church in tears, and my husband said, "Why don't you take a break?" And so I did, and it's been 2 years. But after that, I had stopped going to church, and I felt like that was kind of the last straw with my husband, and we started talking about divorce, and it was very hard. Like, we lived away from family, and he called my mom without telling me. He called my mom and had her come down to, like, be with me because he was going to leave, and it was, like, terrifying for me. I had been a stay-at-home mom our whole marriage and everything, so I, like, what was I going to do? And then we decided that we needed to try a little harder, work things out a little bit more, and within a few months of that, we moved to Utah. Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? I was very resistant, like, "Don't take me to that place." But surprisingly, moving to Utah has given me the support and encouragement and love that I need from the post-Mormon community, that I was able to stop putting so much of that on my husband, and we have been able to heal our marriage, which is such a relief. And he's actually going to be here on Saturday for a panel. So if you guys are going to be here on Saturday, then you should come to our panel, and we'll talk a little more about this. But so my personal faith transition, like, taking so long, I have lots of friends who only took a few months to transition out of the church, and I took 4 years to transition out of the church, and I was so worried about the relationships and if I was damaging them to the point of no return. My family is all still very active. My dad has had a lot of very spiritual experiences, and he tries to, like, you know, say, you don't think I'm crazy, do you? I've had this experience. And I'm like, "No, Dad, I think you had this experience that was very important to you, but that doesn't help me." And my mom keeps hoping I'll come back, and I have a sister that's very, very devout, and I can't even talk religion with her. But I mean, I'm trying so hard, and I think that's something that all of us have to do if we have left Mormonism, whether like actually leaving the church or just like mentally, even if you're attending but you're just not there. Like, we have to learn how to navigate these relationships. And I've at times found myself like pulling away. Like, I talk to my family every day. We have a group chat, and we literally are talking every single day. And it's been interesting because the first thing, like, if there's a tragedy that happens or something, the first thing is always like, prayers, let's have a fast, and let's do this. And it's so hard for me because I'm on the outside now to be like, I'm thinking about you, positive vibes, like, where's the GoFundMe? But it's been a really interesting journey for me, and I really do appreciate. I don't know how much time I've taken so far.
You're still good.
You can stop. Gosh, you guys. No, there's so much I want. Like, I want to talk about it. I love talking about myself, but who doesn't? I'm worried about boring everybody. No. What was I? I feel like I was about to go somewhere. I'm really appreciative that I've been able to participate in this and like share, like have a voice, because I do think it's really important. It's very healing for me. Like, I've lived in Utah now for 1 year, just over a year, and I can't believe how much better things are for me now. Like, I've been out of the church for over 2 years now, and I've been mending relationships, like with my husband, with my family, and I feel like I'm more confident in myself, my own beliefs. Like, since moving to Utah, I've taken up drinking coffee and other things, and I got a tattoo, and my husband is still married to me. So, I mean, it's been really, really helpful to have an outside community to rely on. So, I'm just very grateful for this opportunity. And I think I'm ready to turn the time over to Anthony. And also, I'm totally willing to answer questions later, too. So, thank you.
That was awesome. Thanks. So I think that this maybe gives a nice spectrum, because I was the one that always knew the church was true. At least I thought I did. So my parents joined the church when I was 3 years old in the Phoenix area of Arizona. I grew up in East Mesa, Arizona. And my parents, as converts in the 70s, were very much Ezra Taft Benson, Bruce R. McConkie, Boyd K. Packer types of literalist black and white Mormons. We would read Mormon doctrine for family home evening, you know. And as a teenager, my parents would send me to Cleon Skousen's workshops. So that was the Mormonism that I grew up with, you know. And I knew all about the different thousands of years books from Cleon Skousen and so forth. So about 22 years ago, after I returned from a mission in Spain, in Barcelona, and married my wife within 9 months of meeting her, we ended up moving to Billings, Montana. So Billings, Montana has a pretty good representation of the church, probably somewhere between 4 and 5% of the population are LDS in Billings. We have a full-size temple. And when we moved to Billings, my wife and I, both as pretty Orthodox believing members, we knew that we couldn't live there very long because they didn't have a temple at the time. But sure enough, within a few months of us moving to Billings, they announced that they would have a temple. And so we thought, well, maybe we could raise our family there. And over the subsequent about 20 years, I had lots of opportunities to serve in the church. I spent about 9 years at different times as the adult gospel doctrine teacher in the church. And I knew the church was true. And the reason was the construct that when you had what we would call spiritual experiences, the LDS construct was that those were divine witnesses of truth. And I had those. And when I would prepare my lesson as a gospel doctrine teacher, I would pray sincerely for guidance as to what principles of the lesson to emphasize. And I would feel guided as to what to emphasize. And when I would go to class, I would shake people's hands as they would come into the room. And with a prayer in my heart, I would ask for guidance as to if someone in the class needed something, that we could talk about that thing. And as I was teaching my class, it was not infrequent that I would feel inspired to emphasize something or to ask somebody a question and so forth. And I had spiritual experiences. So you might call it the elevation emotion, or you might call it the illusory truth effect, where you repeat something over and over again so you believe it's true. Or you might call it confirmation bias. Or you might call it what Brené Brown refers to it as a spiritual connection that exists between human beings that connect us together and make us feel like we're part of something bigger than ourselves. But I experienced those things over and over and again. And the construct was that that meant that the subject matter or the representation or the ritual or whatever was true. I spent years on the Stake High Council. I spent years as a ward mission leader, and I was very visible in my ward and my stake. But I'm very analytical, and I remember stuff well. And so I had very, very heavy metaphorical shelves, where when I would run into something like Joseph Smith praying to Jehovah, the Eternal Father, in the Kirtland Dedicatory Prayer, or stuff in the Book of Mormon about skin color and a curse, or the Trinitarianism there, or other kinds of things that I would find, I would shelve those things because they would cause dissonance, because I had so much certainty, because my spiritual experiences let me know with certainty that this was true. And at times, I would shelve my inner voice and conscience. Like when the exclusion policy came out in November 2015, I knew in my heart that that could not be from God. But I shelved it because the narrative was that DNC 138, when they're speaking with inspiration, they're speaking as if it's from God's own voice. And I thought, well, maybe I'm not seeing something that they're seeing, and I need to be more humble, and I shelved it. So I had very heavy shelves, but I had so much certainty. And Mormonism was a huge part of my identity and my community and my reputation, everything. Also, I was a social libertarian. So I had a problem with Prop 8. I had a problem with the church pushing against or fighting against same-sex marriage, because I felt like if the government could say something like that, the government could say what Mormons believe. Are they allowed to or not? So I was a social libertarian. So 27 months ago, in 2 days, my wife and I were just about to become empty nesters. I had spent a total of about 4 years over the last 20 being an ordnance worker at the Billings Temple, less than 5 minutes from my house. And as empty nesters, we would be able to be ordnance workers together, because, of course, women can't be ordnance workers if there are children in the home, in the church. And I was going to retire early when I was in my 60s and sell my business, and we were going to serve multiple missions for the rest of our life. That was our plan. So 27 months and 2 days ago, my wife was down in Logan, Utah, helping my son move from winter housing to summer housing because he was going to grad school there. And my then almost 23-year-old son came out to my wife as gay. And we had always questioned as to whether he was gay. We even asked him. And he said, no, I don't think so. But he never dated men or women. But he came out to my wife as gay. And I knew in my heart that he didn't choose it. So anxiously that evening, I'm home alone on a Friday evening, April 29th, 2016. And I go online to search for resources as to how an active believing member can support a gay child, knowing in their heart that God wouldn't want them to live a life absent the kind of intimacy that my wife and I share. And that evening, I stumbled on the Gospel Topics essays and the CES letter and Mormon Think and the Fair Mormon Table of Contents and Mormon Stories. And for the next 72 hours, with almost no sleep, I recognized that my construct of spiritual experiences being divine witnesses of truth didn't work for me, because it had witnessed of things that were demonstrably not true as I read those things. And the essays confirmed that. And what happened then is that God disappeared. The day before, I could pray to prepare a lesson. I was the ward mission leader seeding a Spanish branch for our stake in our ward. I could pray, I could prepare a lesson, I could feel the Spirit. And just because of things that I read, God disappeared. Gina Colvin talks about God disappearing from the corner of the room where you knew him, and God disappeared from me. I felt like I was falling through a hole. Over the subsequent weeks, James Fowler calls it the dark night of the soul, but mine lasted for months.
I had never prayed so much in my life. I pleaded in prayer, and I read scriptures, and I did all the Sunday school answers. Within a week and a half, I finally went to my good friend, my bishop, and I said, I need a calling for a faithful unbeliever because I ran into this stuff. And he had never read the essays. His is a pastoral calling. He could not give me satisfying answers. And 6, 8, 10 hours a day, and every waking hour on the weekend, I would try to make the church true again. I would read all the apologetics. I would listen to hours and hours of podcasts. I would get up at 6 in the morning so I could go on an hour and a half or 2 hour hike to listen to a podcast at 1.5 times speed so I could get more in. Because maybe if I just studied something else more, I could find that morsel that I could make it all work for me again. Because I was losing everything. I lost God. I was afraid of losing my relationship with my active believing wife. I was going to lose all my friends and my community. I was going to lose my future, everything. It really was an acute faith crisis. About 6 weeks in June of 2016, I found the A Thoughtful Faith Facebook group. And almost shaking, I was going through the vetting process. Please let me in, right? I need to know I'm not crazy. And I got on, and I did a post, and Lindsay Hanson Park messaged me, and she says, oh my gosh, I'm totally in Billings, Montana. Let's go to breakfast tomorrow. And the next morning, I went to breakfast with Lindsay and her friend from Billings and Lindsay's husband. And they sat with me and they held my hand. And they took months and months off of my dark night of the soul. They gave me a reprieve. It was amazing. And the reaction from the people of the online A Thoughtful Faith Facebook group, it was like there were 200 people surrounding me and holding me in their arms as I laid in bed and wept. And my wife held me. So Lindsay says, you have to come to Sunstone. And my wife said, you have to get therapy or go to a group or something. Because I would go to church on Sunday and I would be so depressed that I couldn't even go to work the next day. Because if I raised my hand to make a comment to correct something that was wrong, I was going to wound my wife and my friends. And if I didn't, I was a fraud. And it was so much dissonance, I couldn't do it. And so I came to Sunstone, and I went to a Mormon Stories Faith Transitions workshop. And Gina Colvin and Thomas McConkie, if you know who they are, they're like celebrity. They were in the workshop with me and John DeLynn, and it was a small group. And between the sessions that I went through in Sunstone 2 years ago and that Faith Transitions workshop and the interactions with the A Thoughtful Faith group, literally they pulled me out of the dark night of the soul. So then I had the process of grieving. We go through stages of grief when we have loss. And I lost my identity and my relationships. And my wife told me, you need to not go to church anymore because I need my husband back, because it was too depressing for me. And my bishop said, if it doesn't lift you up to come to church, then you need to take a break too. And so with their support, I started a sabbatical and I processed the stages of grief. And with help of people online, but there was so much value in being face-to-face with people. The online support groups are amazing, but there's an extra dynamic of being face-to-face, and there just weren't that many people in Billings, Montana, or so I thought. So in December of 2016, I thought, well, I'm going to start doing limited privacy posts on Facebook where I'm going to talk about some of the essay issues, just find out if some of my active believing friends, who all of a sudden I disappeared for at church, maybe they have a way of reconciling these things. So on December 1st, I did a Facebook post about the essays coming out, and I included about 100 local friends. Members of the church, and sure enough, within about 3 or 4 hours live in that post, one of my friends read the essays and totally fell apart, right in front of everybody, right? And I decided we needed to create a Mormon Spectrum group, so we did. Over the subsequent months, I continued to process the stages of grief, and I told myself that I wouldn't make a decision about resigning, or I wouldn't make a decision about being fully public about it until it had been at least a year. And sure enough, right at about a year, the wife of my friend, who's a home teacher, who had been I've been talking through this, thought she was sending me a private message on Facebook. And she posted on my Facebook wall, "We just want you to know that we love you, even if you're not a Mormon anymore," and outed me. But it was okay, because the way people responded was exactly the way they needed to. And when I was public and through those limited privacy posts, I found that I was not alone. And so we created a Mormon Spectrum group. Now there are more than 20 members in our group. And we meet one evening a month, and we have a standing Sunday morning coffee meetup to support each other. It's been huge in our community, not just to me, but the other people that are in the group, to know that they're not alone, to be able to have someone sit with them and hold their hand. All along, because I had to figure out how to deconstruct and understand everything, when I would figure out how to reconcile something, I would post something on A Thoughtful Faith or on Thoughtful Transitions or one of the others. And what's fun is it kind of gave me kind of a diary or a history of what my transition of what my experience was. Like, one thing that was really important was how to overcome the sense of betrayal, because I had betrayed myself. I was a critical thinker in all areas of my life except for my faith. And I betrayed myself. And I felt betrayed by the brethren who I loved. So I wrote about how I processed that and understood that. One of the most important posts that I made was somewhat recent. And last October, November, I returned to my mission field, to Barcelona, Spain, because I needed to understand what those spiritual experiences were. Were they what Gina Colvin refers to as spiritual experiences, are communion with God instead of witnesses of truth? I didn't believe in an interventionist creator God, the God of the Lost Keys, you know, anymore. But I felt spiritual connection. So I returned to Spain and visited the families that I taught. I served in one ward for 13 months. We had lots of success. That ward is a stake now. The people that I baptized are leaders there. And I needed to understand what that was. And while I was there, some of them know of my changed beliefs, and they accepted me as if not a day had gone by. And they would tell me stories of what the church had meant in their life, and I was able to celebrate that with them. Somehow, I was able to do that, because the pain of the loss, I had gone through the grieving. But through that, through seeing those experiences, and then through visiting the Sagrada Familia and a Roman city with Roman ruins and a Jewish quarter of a medieval city and so forth, I was able to see all sorts of devotion to the divine. And it was beautiful. Lots more feminine divine than there is in Mormonism. And I experienced spirituality in a Catalan mass at Montserrat. And I experienced a lot of other things. And around that time then, and on the way home, I read the book, or listened to it on Audible, Sapiens, as well as God, A Human History. That one, second one's by Reza Aslan. And began to reconcile what my spiritual experiences were, and what they meant for me, and what my path was going forward, and that the beauty that I experienced in Mormonism, that I didn't have to throw those things away. Those experiences were real and sacred when I taught gospel doctrine and was able to share a spiritual connection with people in my class, even though I don't believe some of those things that I taught are true anymore. So I ended up creating a blog. It's called Unpacking Ambiguity. And I'm incrementally transferring over some of the things that I wrote. So for peace in my life, I resigned because I needed to set a boundary. because I knew that the dissonance that I continued to experience with this underlying desire to reconnect with my tribe wasn't going to work, because I was going to either wound my wife and my friends, or I would wound myself by returning. And what I feel called to or led to do now is to support people who are in a change of faith or a development of faith, something new, to sort support the LGBT community in my community, and to sit with people, just like Lindsay and her husband sat with me, or just like some of you have sat with me at Sunstone and mourned with me. And I celebrate these relationships and this opportunity. So in any event, that's my story.
We'd like to thank you guys so much for sharing your stories. We're going to open it up for some discussion. Please come line up in front of this mic and speak into the mic so that everyone can hear. And yes, your question will be recorded and the answer will be recorded and be part of the session. So.
Ask anything.
So, first of all, for the gentleman on the end, I didn't catch your name, the one wearing the white shirt. Perhaps I should say the white
Anthony.
And the lightsome shirt.
Yeah, Anthony.
Anthony.
I appreciate it.
Anthony, are you me? Because, wow, our stories are almost right down the line parallel. Holy cow. Yeah, everyone is the same, only different, right? Anyway, so question for all three of you, because I kind of heard each of you touch on it. I heard you mention that one thing that made you a little discomforted was that the Mormon Church tries to get everybody to be the same. And the lady in the middle, you mentioned that you got to a point where you said, well, what do I even believe in now? And Anthony, I believe you mentioned talking about discovering your identity. I think this is something that post-ex former Mormons deal with a lot, is sort of finding their identity and the struggle that it is. Freud describes it as, I think, the dissolution of the ego. That this occurs to people sometimes. Maybe I'm being a little self-centered, but I think it can be a little bit more profound for Mormons that experience a faith crisis, because religion is such an integral part of the identity that we form for ourselves from birth. So what advice do you have on forging and forming a new identity for yourself post-conventional belief?
So, I agree with what you're saying. In Mormonism, we're taught that differentiation is not good, right? Because we have correlation and we all say the same testimony and teach from the same manual and so forth. In other faith traditions, differentiation is not considered bad, because you go and you listen and you might be sitting next to your spouse and interpret the sermon totally differently, and that's okay. But in Mormonism, differentiation is not, it's considered contention even. And so that's why leaving a high demand faith that discourages differentiation can be so incredibly painful, because your identity is so wrapped up in it, and you feel like you potentially lose all your relationships in your community when you differentiate. So that's real. My sense is, I believe that we have power in us individually, and that we should listen to our own voice, inner voice, and our heart and our soul and our body will tell us what to do, and get rid of the programming that we had that makes us think that it's our fault and we have to fix it, but do what we individually feel led to do. And so for me, it was to figure out what my construct of spiritual experiences or divinity are, and how I can connect with and serve other people, and what teachings attributed to Christ really resonate with me, whether or not I believe he was more than just a historical person. That's me. But I have no problem anymore with someone that sits next to me that has a totally different view, because I'm comfortable with the differentiation now. So that's my take.
So for myself, I think finding my identity kind of maybe was a little juvenile. In that I went back to when I was a teenager and all those things that were like behind that Mormon barrier, like that I wasn't allowed to like even think about or do. Like, if I was interested in those things, like now I can go do that. I can go try that. I can talk about that, think about that, taste that, like whatever. And that has been really freeing for me, like knowing now that I'm in charge of myself and I get to explore things on my own. Whatever comes up into my mind, whatever looks interesting to me, I get to try that. And that has been really helpful for me in like recovering my identity.
I'll come in here and grab this mic again. So again, I think this is a case where, because of how I was before I decided to stop attending church, I don't feel like I had a lot to try to do. For me, it was just because all the stuff Mallory just said, I had done when I was younger. I just hit it. Mother, cover your ears. So. No, she already knows. I started smoking when I was, you know, like 16. You know, I drank when I actually didn't do that until I was like 20. I was really behind. So, like, I did those things. I did a lot of stuff that, you know, a lot of people leave the church and they go and do. But, like, I was always kind of me. I just hid a lot of me because it didn't fit the Mormon narrative. So I just stopped hiding it. So, yeah. So, I mean, like, there wasn't a lot of work on my end. I think the harder part was just being able to peel back those layers, and that was really just a lot of testing waters with people who I care about, for whom Mormonism still holds value, still rings true, because I didn't want to jeopardize those relationships. Because, you know, if there were members of the church who I don't care about, I don't care if you don't like that I drink. I literally don't care. But, you know, my friends, my family, that has to be handled in certain ways to make sure that everything's okay. And I will go on the record as saying I did a horrible job with that, with drinking and my wife. I did a lot of drinking before my wife knew I was drinking. And she was very mad at me, and she should have been, because that was a really stupid thing that I did. So don't do it that way. But yeah, so I feel like for me it was kind of whatever. But I think I think the creation of a new identity is, I think, one of those things that, you know, we see people doing this in our various Facebook groups. You know, people who are just freshly leaving the church, and in some cases haven't left yet, are still in it, and, you know, trying to make it work or whatever, and they're trying to figure out like what it's going to look like for them on the other side. And it's really hard to tell people in those situations, like, it's going to be okay. This group of us have managed to do it. There is something on the other side, but because it's so different for everybody, both just in the relationships that they have and what the ones they're trying to maintain, and everyone's situation is different. You know, I've never lived in Utah. I've never had to worry about what it's like to have my next door neighbor be my bishop. I've coastal California, now I live in Baltimore. Can't be less Utah than Baltimore. Trust me. So, you know, it all kind of depends on the individuals, but at the end of the day, it's just being able to figure out, like, what is authentic to you and how much of that you want to share. And I think I think one of the biggest things is that, for like in the church, they want everyone to fit within their little boxes, but they also expect you to be open about everything at the same time. But you can only be open about being in the box. Right? Like, we want to know everything about you as long as everything is in this box. And once you're out, you have to decide who do you let into what box. You're not being told everything gets to go out. And that's just trial and error sometimes in figuring out who gets access to what box. Anyone else?
Hello, thank you for sharing. All three of you are still married, and you're in somewhat of a different space on these topics than you are from your spouses. Share with us how your relationships may be the same and different. Maybe specifically, is the nature of your conversations with spouse still on topics of religion at all, or maybe they've migrated more to spirituality generally, or maybe they've moved entirely to, you know, innocuous topics, I don't know, mountain climbing, skydiving, something.
I'm going to speak on this first because I'm going to encourage everyone here who has questions about how to handle a mixed-faith marriage to attend the session that Anthony, I, and Mallory's husband and another friend of ours is doing on Saturday. That being said, like I said, like when I came out to my wife, I used the opportunity of ordained women and Kate Kelly's excommunication to start the conversation, and I treaded very lightly about it. It was a lot of like, how do you feel about what these things that are going on? How, because I was testing waters to see what I could say. I actually had a conversation with my wife over this last weekend about what she was comfortable with me saying about her here. So my wife is still somewhat believing and is currently inactive. She hasn't really attended church much since she moved to Baltimore earlier this year. She's doing she has whatever sort of journey, faith journey she's on right now. I don't know where it's going to land. I'm not going to say I don't care where she lands, because I want her to land whatever, like wherever it works best for her. And hopefully that still works best for us, which I think it will. But, you know, everyone's got to do their thing, and I think it's just important about being able to keep dialogue open, which isn't always easy when, again, high-demand religion, church says this is how it should be, it's check these boxes. If someone can't check those boxes, you know, when, like, you're talking about, like in the eyes of the church, eternal consequences, right? It's, you know, it's not like, you know, how are we going to split up the bank account? It's, your soul is now not the same as mine forever. Like, we're eternally separate. And, you know, I, again, another time in which I feel like I'm kind of on a different page than some other folks, because I had a wife that was already kind of on a very liberal end of Mormonism to begin with. She has lesbian mother who was excommunicated. My wife's fairly liberal to begin with. She's, you know, doing her own little journey, so I've been fortunate that I haven't had to deal with that too much. But it's kind of just, those conversations are kind of, you know, keep, again, kind of test waters, whatever. That's just my take, but...
So we'll talk more about this in that session, but early on in our marriage, we had challenges, and we found the book, The Five Love Languages, and I jumped on that to the extent that I would, like, consult businesses with how to use that, you know, in their setting, and I taught it in, like, every fifth Sunday, you know, in our stake and so forth. And early on in my faith transition, in one of the online groups, they said, you need to double and triple down your expressions of emotional intimacy to your spouse as you depart from Orthodoxy, so that your spouse can feel totally confident in your love for her, and that she can distinguish your marriage from your ceiling. And so I did, even in the midst of the dark night of the soul, I went all the way out, and my wife recognized that and saw that. But what we ended up with was a hole in our relationship with our spiritual intimacy, because we didn't share spiritual or religious practice anymore. So since then, we have actively sought for ways to nourish spiritual intimacy, and it's primarily through service to others. So one project that we're doing now is we've raised $26,000 to buy, on a GoFundMe project, to buy a replacement trailer home for a woman in her 60s and her disabled 25-year-old daughter, and she runs the laundry at the temple. And her husband's has Alzheimer's and is a nursing home. And I was her high priest group leader for a period of time. And it's something that we could have never done in the church, because it would have been too big for the ward to buy a home for someone, right? So my wife and I decided we were going to do this, and we talked with the ward. So I've engaged my stake presidency and a lot of my old friends who have contributed to this, and they're going to help financially and with labor. And my wife and I are doing this project together to nourish spiritual intimacy through practicing those teachings attributed to Jesus. And when we're done with this project, we'll go do the next one. So those are the main things that we've done. My wife is the first counselor in the Stake Relief Society presidency, and she's an ordinance worker. And she supports our gay son and his partner, and she supports me as a resigned member. And when she was called to be the first counselor in the Stake Relief Society presidency, for some reason the Stake presidency called me to go in for the interview. So we went in together, and my wife had me, you know, hand in hand, unabashedly, me there as the apostate, right? And it didn't matter. So we support each other in the places that we find peace in our life.
So I think in my marriage, my husband is very conservative. And of course, I am the opposite. And at the beginning of my faith crisis, I'm very vocal. I have to talk through everything. And my husband is the opposite. And so I was like continually telling him like every single thing that came to my mind, and he was trying to take it in good graces for a long, long time, and then it just was like too much. And finally, we decided to stop trying to change each other. And that is what really made all the difference for us. Like, once it was like, okay, I don't need you to leave the church. And he's like, I don't need you to come back. And finding each other through that is really what saved us. And yeah, I think now we can actually talk about church things again, because I mean, I was talking about church things and he was trying to listen, and then we had to just like take it off the table because it was not going well. But now I'm starting to be able to like bring things up again, and he can bring things up again, and we can actually have a normal conversation about religious topics again. And it's all because we're not trying to change each other's mind. We're just trying to connect through things that are important to us.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I was really clear with my wife at the beginning. I was like, I want you to stay Mormon if that's what you want to do. I'm not like, me leaving the church or not attending, whatever, however I want to phrase it, is not about you. Like, this is a me thing. You should continue doing whatever works for you. I'm here to support you no matter what. Because I want my wife to be happy, and if she's happy in the church and I'm happy out of the church, as long as we can find a way to make that work, I'm good. You know, and I think it's important that people know that, you know, you're not trying to share something you read to try to deconvert them. And if you want to hear more about that, Anthony and I are doing a session tomorrow talking about communicating across differences in faith and belief. I should have gone on a mission. I'm a good salesperson. I lied. I'm a good salesperson.
A shout out to Dr. Christy Money's Mixed Faith Marriage Workbook. That was when my husband and I brought up, when divorce was on the table. That was the thing where, like, okay, there's this workbook that we could access online for free. Let's give it a shot. And we started working on that together, and that's when we were like, okay, I think we can fix things. So if you need that, look it up.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many resources online. Like, part of me is like really, really glad that, you know, for all of us that go through all this stuff now, because, you know, even 10 years ago, this, like, the online support was just way different. You didn't have the kind of communities that you have now. You don't have all the same resources, certainly not 20 years ago. There's mixed faith marriage, you know, Facebook groups for folks. So I found Mallory to come to our one on Saturday in the afternoon about mixed faith marriages. A thoughtful faith, the first one I was excommunicated from. Thoughtful transitions, which I was excommunicated from, and they rebaptized me. They don't actually call it that. Those are my words to make it Mormon-y. There's a lot of stuff out there. It's a matter of looking around, and if you find me on Facebook, and one of you already has, feel free to like hit me up on Facebook, and I can point you guys in directions and point you to Facebook groups or whatever, because there's a lot of stuff out there for all of this kind of stuff now.
There's a story that we all are familiar with about King Solomon, and there are two women that they have children, and one of the infants dies and the other one's alive, and the two women are arguing over which of the living child, which one of them is the mother, right? And they go to King Solomon, and King Solomon says, well, we'll go ahead and just cut the baby in half and give you each half then. And the woman who was not the mother said, okay. And the woman who was the mother loved that child enough to have that child live in a home that was not her home. So it's a great example if you apply it to mixed faith marriages. Like, if you know that your spouse lives or dies in a home that is not your spiritual home, do you love your spouse enough for them to live in a different home, and to be comfortable with that degree of differentiation is what's necessary in order to be able to maintain a mixed faith relationship.
Come on down. You're the next contestant. And ask us a question.
Yeah, question. So I'm curious. I think Nick kind of touched on it a little bit, but Mallory and Anthony, what is your relationship now with the church? Because it sounds like all three of you, you may be out of the church, but you're not really, because you're married to people who are in it. So you're not away from it, right? So I'm curious if you attend functions at church, or if you're constantly being invited to church events, or to, speak at something or whatever. Because especially from Anthony serving in the high priest, sounds like you may have had pretty strong relationships with other high council, state president, bishops, all that kind of stuff. So I'm just curious what your relationships are, and if you hate the church, have resentment, animosity, what your thoughts are there. So, yeah.
There was a time that I was pretty angry. Now I don't attend except for to support people. So like if I have a friend who's child is going on a mission or something, I'll go to a farewell or something like that. But other than that, I don't go to church activities because it's too easy to wound people, and I don't want to do that. I want to preserve my friendships and relationships. So I engage with my friends in the church outside the church in other activities, whether we go jeeping or whether we do a exercise challenge or something like that. And this example of what my wife and I are doing with this fundraiser to buy a replacement trailer home, it's not just for us. It's my wife and I engaging people in the church in a productive and healthy way outside of the church. So, and in my Mormon, or in our Mormon Spectrum group that has more than 20 members now, more than half of them are active still in the church to some degree or another. And the stake presidency, who are all good friends of mine, are aware of our group, and they don't take away people's temporal recommends if they're in our Spectrum group. So we're doing our best to engage people. I feel like until people are ready to unpack the mess or the ambiguity, all you do is alienate relationships if you try to crash their shelves.
I actually sang in sacrament meeting 2 weeks ago at my in-laws' ward building, so I think things are pretty good. I will attend like ward parties with my family, and I try to be nice. Everyone knows that I don't want them. Like I think I might have offended my Relief Society president, because she invited me to something and I told her that I wasn't interested in a kind of a bold, blunt way. But I'm definitely try to not wound relationships. I think that's the biggest thing. So I try not to be too angry about it, even though those feelings definitely do come up sometimes.
So I don't. I'm not angry at the church. I get angry at certain things that the church does, November policies, things like that. But again, I attribute a lot of this to having never really been deep in with belief. it's a group of people and they're doing what they feel is the right thing. I just don't agree with it. That's okay. They are entitled to do that. I think it's unfortunate that it hurts people, but I'm not angry at the church. You know, I haven't attended any church function at all since I moved to Baltimore a year and a half ago. My records are still in California, and they're going to stay that way until my wife moves them. So probably, hopefully, never. Mom, don't tell them where I live. The last time that I attended church was December. Was December 2 years ago, I guess. And I had been essentially inactive up until November, when my wife, who was the choir director, said, "Hey, we need another guy to sing in the choir." And I was like, "Okay, so I will come for that." So I would come a little bit. I'd sit in the foyer with Starbucks. In the foyer. I was in California. People are different there. And I sat there in my shorts and my flip-flops and my sleeveless t-shirts with my very clearly a Starbucks cup through all 3 hours. And then I'd just think, I didn't have to. I could have just gone for choir practice, but I was like, I'm going to be here. I'm going to suffer the whole time. And I do choir practice, and that was that. The last time I spoke in church was the Fast Testimony meeting of that December. I got up and I bore my testimony of how great that ward was and those people were. Which is, once I decided I was kind of done pretending, I never wanted to get up and bear my testimony and say anything that I didn't actually feel was true. So I got up that day because it was the last time. We were actually about to move out of the ward anyways, but I wanted to tell everyone there that how much I appreciated how well they had been to me, despite the fact that I clearly was not on the same page with them. And I encouraged them to pay attention to that sign outside that says, you know, visitors welcome, and to keep treating everyone who walked through those doors as well as they had treated me. And if everyone in the church did that, the church would be a much better place. Because that is that's a testimony that I had in that ward. So that was like the last time I said anything at church, but I haven't been in a church building in like 2 years now. It's kind of nice. I go to the gym on Sundays instead because I need to. I think this is probably the last question.
Quickly, and how do you guys consolidate your temple ceiling in your marriage? I mean, if you're outside of the church, your ceiling is canceled, I assume. Could you address that?
Your ceiling is inactive. It's not canceled. For me to have my ceiling canceled, I'd have to have my active believing wife agree for me to petition to the First Presidency to do that. And I would never ask her to do that. I would love for like our 30th anniversary or something like that to renew our vows. My wife isn't in a place to do that right now. It doesn't matter to me. I have a friend who is in a second marriage, was a convert, married my friend, and she subsequently learned about polygamy, lost belief in the church, realized that she was sealed as a second wife because my friend didn't cancel his sealing to the first wife. And now she wants to leave the church and ask her active believing husband to request a cancellation of sealing because of how wounding it is for her to be sealed as a second wife. And having it being suspended isn't enough for her. So everybody's situation's a little bit different, but it doesn't cancel the sealing.
So since I'm still technically a member, not really a problem until I die, if nothing changes until we're all dead. I mean, I think it's interesting because I've had people ask me that, generally Mormons who are trying to use that as a, you know, like, well, you can't leave because you're a poor wife. And I just basically tell them the same thing that I was told time and time again about all sorts of various questions about what happens if a family X happens this. It's God will make it work, right? Like, God will make things piece together. This is a question, like, so again, my wife, her parents are divorced. How does that work out? Both of her parents are remarried, both to women. And my wife is, you know, if you ask my wife, like, what happens, you know, how does this all work? She goes, God will make it work. That's kind of my take on it.
My wife's the same. She believes that we'll be together in the eternities, and she believes that our gay son will be gay in the eternities with his partner. So she's very, very nuanced with regard to that.
My name is still on the church record right now, and I am fine with that because I am not believing at all. And for my husband's peace of mind, I'm like, we'll just keep it that way so he doesn't have any questions about it.
I mean, if my wife or the Mormon Church is correct and there is a whole whatever afterwards, I was wrong, and based on Mormon theology, I'll be given a chance. If I'm right and there's nothing, I was right and there's nothing. I don't even get to, like, lord it over anyone because we won't know. So, I feel like at least for me, because there's so many like real life like things that like today, here and now, I just don't worry about what's going to happen in the possible eventuality of an afterlife, because I just, you know, I don't want to live my life hoping for that when there's so much stuff that you can pass by in this life worrying about what's happening in the next one. So I think that's time. Thanks, everybody. Feel free to come up and say hello.